Thank you. Be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument in the cause of McElveen versus Jacobs et al.
May it please the court, Mr. Rob Wiley and Mr. William Martin will present arguments for the petitioner. Mr. Rob Wiley, welcome.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Rob Wiley, and along with William Ogden, I represent the petitioner, KHOUTV of Houston. This is a libel case. The trial court granted KHOU a summary judgment, and the Court of Appeals reversed. Today, the petitioner presents two fundamental arguments compelling reversal of the Court of Appeals decision and reinstatement of the trial court's summary judgment. First, the broadcast at issue was true. Second, the broadcast at issue was privileged under Section 73.002 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code and the concurrent common law privilege, well recognized in this court and in virtually all American jurisdictions, that protects fair, true, and impartial accounts of executive and official proceedings. I will speak to the truth and privileged nature of the broadcast, and Mr. Ogden will present our rebuttal to the respondent's case. This case involves no real disputed facts, so there may be questions about the interpretation of those facts. Channel 11 broadcast in December of 1982, almost 7 years ago, a story stating that the City of Houston's Public Integrity Review Group was investigating the use of city employees on city time to care for the father, city water maintenance manager, Emmerich Jacobs. The broadcast stated that employees in the water maintenance division were turning in overtime so that they could get jobs done, work missed, while caring for Mr. Jacobs' ailing father. The broadcast also stated that police investigators had searched one department office for a gun, but had found liquor bottles instead. Several months after the broadcast, the Public Integrity Review Group, an arm of the City of Houston's legal department, a part of the mayor's office, issued a report detailing the investigation. The report confirmed the truth of the broadcast and its privileged nature under Section 73.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. Petitioners attached a copy of the report, the PIRG report, to their motion for summary judgment and verified it by affidavits of Assistant City Attorney Brenda Loudermilk and Special Investigator D.A. Schulte, who was one of the officers conducting the investigation. That report is part of Appendix B to our application for writ of error. Emmerich Jacobs and Joyce Moore, another employee in the department, sued for libel, slander, invasion of privacy, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. The trial court, after extensive discovery, granted petitioner's motion for summary judgment in May of 1987. This court, the Court of Appeals, one justice dissent, reversed. This court granted petitioner's application for writ of error on 5 of the 6 points raised.
Counsel, let me ask you a preliminary question. This court received your brief. Did you ever receive a brief from respondent?
No, Your Honor, we did not. I will begin with our first argument that this broadcast was true and therefore under well-recognized principles of libel and defamation was not actionable. The broadcast stated first that there was an investigation in progress and stated the areas that the investigation covered. There was, as the PIRG report confirmed, an investigation. The plaintiffs admit that and there is no dispute about that. The investigation concerned not only matters that were stated in the broadcast, but also a number of other matters much more serious than those concerned or dealt with in the broadcast. First, the broadcast reported allegations that city employees on city time had been used to care for the father of the water maintenance division manager, Emmerich Jacobs. One employee, the PIRG report stated, gave investigators a sworn statement that she had been asked by respondent Joyce Moore to perform such tasks. The report, the broadcast report, also dealt with overtime practices, including the allegation that employees who performed tasks for Mr. Jacobs' father later turned in overtime so that they could get their regular city jobs done.
Does it make any difference that this was a PIRG investigation as opposed to something more informal?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. We would contend that in either event, the privilege attaches. And I would point this court to the comments in Restatement Section 611, which recognize that once an official agency files a report, then the privilege attaches. I would also direct this court to the wording in the statute, which provides two of the bases that we come before this court today. First, that executive proceedings are protected, accounts of executive proceedings. And second, that official government proceedings of a non-judicial character, which enforce the law. So under either rationale, this court would be empowered to reverse the Court of Appeals decision because the privilege would apply. The report also...
Do you agree with the Court of Appeals that just simply saying it is alleged or the person here is accused by someone of certain events, that by itself is not enough to prevent the statement from being defamatory?
No, Your Honor, we do not in this context. And we contend that that statement in the Court of Appeals decision is its fundamental error. In effect, what the Court of Appeals failed to do was to recognize that 73002 and the common law privilege operate as an exception to the basic defamation rule that republication does not alleviate liability. What the statute allows you to do is publish an otherwise defamatory statement if it's contained in an official proceeding as defined in the statute. And it's that test that the Court of Appeals, we contend, failed to recognize. The statements that the Court of Appeals made are correct statements of law. The Court of Appeals simply applied them improperly under the facts of this case and of any case involving the privilege report.
Now, this report was made after your book test and not before. Is that correct?
The PIRG report was released after the broadcast was made.
It was released, had it been prepared and that's what you had seen?
Well, Your Honor,
it's not. You're just reporting similar facts that then later appeared in a report.
Your Honor, it does not appear in the record as to exactly what the state of the report was at the time of the broadcast. It appeared likely that the investigation was underway and the reporter conferred with the investigators and got his information. And I might add that there is, in the cases dealing with this privilege, no requirement that the reporter actually look at the report in advance. That was the holding in Walker versus Globe News, and I would point the court to two other decisions in other places which recognize that as well. First, the Third Circuit's decision in Time Inc. versus Medica, which is cited in our brief. That case involved FBI records, and the court specifically held that it was not necessary for the reporter to rely upon the FBI reports that issued there in order for the privilege to attach.
But you say, is it just your speculation that he probably talked to the investigator? Is there nothing in the evidence as to where the reporter got the information?
No, Your Honor, there is nothing that would suggest that he looked at the report.
But there's no positive statement anywhere where he got the information.
No, Your Honor, there
could have been just speculation on the part of the reporter.
I suppose that is a possibility. However,
doesn't that change the case?
No, Your Honor, we would contend that it doesn't, because the test is whether or not the account of the broadcast is fair, true, and accurate, an accurate account of a PIR, of a report, of an official government proceeding. And we would note that if the government, if the media were held to a standard of where it had to wait for government agencies to release reports, that it couldn't go out and gather information in the way that broadcasters and newspaper publishers typically do, it had to wait for these reports, then there would be certainly much less information delivered to the public, and one of the rationales for this privilege would not be effective.
But the reporter was not asked at the time of trial where he got his information.
Well, Your Honor, this came up on summary judgment, and there is no statement in the record as to exactly how he got the information. It's simply our contention that the cases interpreting this privilege do not require that.
Counsel, I have laid side by side the verbatim news report and the PIRG report. Are there any discrepancies?
Your Honor, there is only one possible interpretation that would suggest there's a discrepancy. And that one is the fact that the statement about the search for a gun came from Officer Schulte's affidavit. That's not explicitly stated in the report. However, the other part of that sentence that you're referring to is stated in the report, the fact that there was a search and that they turned up liquor bottles. So I will concede that there is perhaps an argument that there's a slight variation, but that's the only variation. And Officer Schulte's affidavit confirmed the truth of that statement as well.
Suppose, sir, that defamatory statements are made to a public agency about one of its employees, and that agency begins investigation of those statements, even though it questions whether they're true or not. Is the republication of the defamatory statements that have been made by another prior to determination of whether they're true or not by the public agency, is that protected under the statute?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe it would be, because I don't believe you have an official proceeding under the set of circumstances that you've outlined, Justice Doggett. I believe that under that set of circumstances, you would have a question as to whether there was an official proceeding. But that's not this case. The report here, as Justice Cook points out, if you look at them side by side, there's almost no difference. And that would not be the case that you outlined.
If the report had not issued in this case, would there have been a proceeding?
It would, Your Honor, depend upon whether there was any other kind of investigation or any other kind of document that might be construed as a proceeding. For example, I would note the police report cases where, such as some of those we cited in our brief, like Bell versus Associated Press. There, the reporter simply calls the police and they report that so-and-so has been arrested. And under those circumstances, the courts have not required that the reporter look at those records or anything of that sort. If under these circumstances there had been no report ever issued, then I think you would have a closer case, and you would have to look at whether or not there were any documents that might be construed as an official proceeding.
So is whether there is a proceeding or not, is that a fact question or a law question?
Your Honor, in the first instance, it's a matter of law. And I think the cases are very clear on that. The court can decide as a matter of law whether there is a proceeding under the statute. And that is apparently what the trial court did here. That is not to suggest that there couldn't be factual situations where a court determined that looking at the summary judgment proof before it, it couldn't say as a matter of law there was a proceeding.
Suppose the report ultimately issues, but that the report that ultimately issues concludes that the accusations against the employee were vicious lies. Does this statute protect your reporting on the investigation of those lies?
If I understand your question, Justice Doggett, you're saying that somewhere along these things have been reported as the investigation was in progress,
right?
And then the report concluded that it was all false. Would in that case, Your Honor, I would say that if the news media fails to report the ultimate conclusion of the official investigation, the statute would not protect. But if there were official government documents, for example, documenting these charges and these allegations as the investigation went forward, then we would contend that, yes, the privilege would protect them while the investigation was in progress. The report is finally issued. It comes out. It says it was all bad. It didn't happen. Then in that case, I think the privilege probably wouldn't attach.
So if that, now let me be sure I understand. If there was a report going on and the media reported that a certain person was being investigated for certain conduct, which if otherwise alleged would be defamatory, and then a report ultimately issues that clears the person of that conduct, your position is that the media has to report that
that final result or else the prior report was not privileged?
Your Honor, I believe that would be, as I understand this statute, I think that this statute would cover that, would not cover that final failure. And it would be our position that, in fact, what had happened here is that the statute had been violated. If you look at the statute, what the statute says is that you abuse the privilege by reporting with actual malice once the matter ceases to be a public concern. Well, the matter would be a public concern, and under that fact scenario, I think what was plaintiff could make a good case that the reporter had, by failing to report that final exoneration, had in fact acted with malice. Your Honor, the Court of Appeals incorrectly decided this case largely because of the privilege problem and its failure to understand that there can be such things as a newsworthy defamation. The Court of Appeals failed to realize that when an allegedly defamatory statement is contained in an official report, the privilege permits publication without liability. This broadcast, therefore, was privileged as a fair, true, and impartial account of an executive proceeding. And the privilege in Section 73.002 means absolutely nothing under the rationale adopted by the Court of Appeals in this case. Because what the Court of Appeals did was, in effect, hold the broadcaster liable for verifying all of the underlying allegations in the report. And that simply is not the way the privilege operates, and it does not recognize the purpose of the privilege. The purpose of the privilege is, as the court in Medico versus Time and other courts have recognized, is to allow the public to supervise public officials by knowing about what is going on in government, and by as well as recognizing an educational rationale that permits the public to get the broadest amount of information about public matters of public concern. There is also...
Let me interrupt you for a minute. The court has issued two cases in this area since you filed your brief, Castle versus Brand and Brasher versus Carr and Teal, since you filed your brief, and I don't believe you filed a supplemental brief. But are these two cases dispositive of your case on the truth aspect of whether or not these reports are defamatory in the first place? I mean, there's no denial here. Is there a denial? Is there a factual issue whether the reports are false?
Well, the trial court didn't think so, and we don't think so.
Well, the Court of Appeals did not say they were false.
The Court of Appeals rejected our truth argument. The Court of Appeals specifically sustained the plaintiff's point of error 1 and 2, which deal with truth. And the Court of Appeals, in its position, that truth, saying that it is alleged, does not permit a defense of truth, rejected our truth contention. There is no doubt that this broadcast was true. Now, as to the point of the effect of the court's two latest decisions on this case, there is a fundamental difference between, I think, what the court was addressing in those cases and in this case. In those cases, the court was dealing with the self-serving affidavits that come up on summary judgment where there's a requirement to show actual malice. That is not really an issue in this case. What is, I think, an issue in this case that Cavanaugh and Carr relate to is whether or not there is sufficient proof of actual malice in this case. That is one of the points of error that this court granted. The summary judgment evidence in this case does not demonstrate actual malice. And there, because, one, it is true, and even if it were that's the main, the fact that it is true. So if our truth defense is good, then as a matter of law, they have no cause of action, both because truth is a defense to defamation and because there's no actual malice that could be shown on the summary judgment evidence. Your Honor, there are a number of other reasons which justify reversing the Court of Appeals and reinstating the trial court summary judgment. including Mr. Jacob's status as a public official, therefore requiring him to show actual malice. The proof...
No Texas court has ever held somebody in a position as, I hate to say obscure, but I can't think of a better word, as obscure as Mr. Jacobs as a public official before, have we?
Your Honor, I'm not certain of the answer to that question. I would address the question in this way. The summary judgment proof, which we have excerpted in, I believe it's Exhibit C to our brief, clearly demonstrates the scope of Mr. Jacobs' responsibility. Mr. Jacobs, and that is the test, what is the scope of the responsibility? Does the public have an interest in that person's qualification independent of the general interest that we all have in the qualification of government officials? We would contend that we showed here that Mr. Jacobs was a public official. If you look at what he said about the scope of responsibility that the city water manager had, the importance of that job to the city, the people of the city of Houston, the fact that he made public statements about his particular job, his responsibilities, and the importance of those responsibilities in the overall operation of public works in the city, we believe there is every reason to hope that he was a public official as defined in New York Times and as set out, the test is set out in Rosenblatt versus Bader. As we cited in our brief, the three cases I believe that are particularly helpful to the court on this point. First, the decision in Moorhead versus Millen in the District of the Virgin Islands, which ironically enough dealt with an individual who was supervisor of waterworks. Second, the Claussen case, which cited out of Washington, a motor pool administrator. The third case, well, actually, those are the two. This case is not like Foster versus Laredo newspapers. This case involves a person who is dealing with we are dealing with the way in which he carries out his public responsibility. And if you recall in the Foster case, the court decided there that the defamation didn't deal with his public responsibility, even though he might have been a public official for some purpose. We are dealing here with a matter of public concern and with his specific public official duties.
So you concede he's a limited purpose public figure?
No, Your Honor, we do not concede he's a limited purpose public figure. We argue that he is a public official. And we're not suggesting that he is a limited purpose public figure, for example, as defined in Bus versus Curtis Publishing Company. We're suggesting that this individual is a public official because of the scope of his duties and their importance in the city of Houston and in the area in which he works. We believe that primarily the issues of truth and privilege should control this case. Petitioners therefore urge this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and render a judgment that the Court of Appeals should have rendered, that is, affirming the judgment of the 80th District Court of Harris County.
Can we do that without reaching the question of whether it's a public official or not, or is it essential that we make a determination of that?
No, Your Honor, it's not necessary for you to do that. The truth issue, the privilege issue, if you reach those and decide those in our favor, dispose of the case. You only need to reach the public official issue if you determine the truth and privilege issue the other way.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from a respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Randall Wilson will present argument for the respondent.
To please the court, my name is Randy Wilson. I represent the respondent. Henry Jacobs, Jr. and Joyce Moore. I did not represent him in the trial court. I was part of the case after the Court of Appeals, or actually I handled the appeal of the Court of Appeals. Let me address Justice Cook's initial question. I have not filed a response brief in this case as of yet. I apologize to the court for that. I'm hopeful that the court will be lenient enough to allow me to file one, which I have ready except for binding tomorrow, and we'll read it before they reach a decision in this case. It doesn't raise any new issues or any cross points. It really responds to the issues raised in the petitioner's application.
Counsel, could you tell us why you did not file a brief?
The only response I can give you, Your Honor, is that I'm a sole practitioner who has repeatedly left of late metaphysically believed that I could do my own work processing better than I could handle it by hiring someone. I've had a lot to handle recently. Don't have a better excuse than that. I don't think it will prejudice anyone to allow the brief to be filed and to at least read it before you reach your decision.
There's no jurisdictional time limit on a response brief, but we're not going to hold up our work on the case waiting for it.
That's my understanding, Your Honor. I'm a little surprised that the petitioners have emphasized their trip intent here today. I came prepared more to respond to the public official question than the Malice question. But I would like to address the truth question. It seems to me important not to confuse the defense of truth with the defense of privilege, which I think the petitioners have done throughout this case, including the Court of Appeals. Truth is an absolute defense that does not depend on privilege. If truth is established as a matter of law, we don't need a privilege. And the cases going back all the way to the 1800s in Texas was held. The tail bearers are as bad as the tail makers. And they're to be punished equally unless they can justify the truth of the underlying allegations. It is not sufficient simply to say that Bill Blow alleged that someone was a crook. You can't justify it on that basis.
This isn't Joe Blow. This is the Public Integrity Review Group.
Yes, Your Honor, and I still don't know who the Public Integrity Review Group is or what authority they have by law. I understand they were connected in some fashion with the City Attorney's Office in Houston. Beyond that, as far as I'm concerned, they're a police agency. I would like to call the Court's attention to some cases that go back to 1939, which really address the same question of statutory privilege. The statute, Article 5432, was essentially identical to Section 73.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. In 1939, this court in Collar Times Publishing Company v. Chandler had a case before in which there had been a newspaper had published some confessions that had been taken by a district attorney in a case in which the plaintiff had been accused, in fact had been indicted, of conspiracy to commit bank robbery. The confession went into some detail about the plan to rob the bank and named the plaintiff. plaintiff sued the newspaper. The newspaper alleged statutory privilege, and this court held that there was no privilege to publish the details set forth in those confessions because the taking of a confession by the district attorney, although it was certainly expedient, was not required by law, and therefore it was not a proceeding. And there they were considering a separate section of the statute dealing with official proceedings, but I don't think there's any real distinction between official proceedings and executive proceedings for our purposes. Now, that case is cited, I believe, in my case in my brief in the Court of Appeal. I have a cite the court would like me to give it to them. It would definitely be in the brief that I'm going to try to file. It's 130 Southwest 2nd, 853. In more recent times, the Court of Appeals have made similar holdings. In Hornby v. Hunter, which is a Corpus Christi case from 1964, the Corpus Christi paper relied on a sheriff's report that a car had been stolen. It turned out the car had not been stolen. And the court held, it's a no-writ case, but the court held that there was no privilege to rely on the sheriff's report under the judicial proceeding or official proceeding provision of the statute. There's also a case, that's the Hornby v. Hunter 385 Southwest 2nd 473.
Do you know how these cases, these tail bearers or embedded the tail maker cases, are faring in federal courts in the post-Solomon?
Well, I think it's
post-Rosenblatt.
It depends on whether or not you're dealing with a public official. Obviously, it depends on whether you're dealing with a media defendant in some cases. They're obviously not faring as well. They're not as liable as the tail maker. They've got the privilege if they're talking about public officials. the other case I'm going to call your attention to is Davila v. Collar Times. which is out of San Antonio, in 311 Southwest 2nd 945. And in that case, there was confusion about some brothers. One brother was involved in drugs and was killed in a police shootout. The newspaper named the wrong brother, relying on a DPS report, was sued, and the court held it was no privilege to rely on the DPS report. I can't see the difference between that and this PIRG investigation, if it was an official agency. It was using police officers. It was acting as a police agency.
So what is the basis of your statement that the PIRG is a police agency?
Simply that in this case it was using police officers to investigate alleged wrongdoing internally within the city department. I have no other basis. I don't think there's anything in the evidence that really explains what PIRG is. Let me, in response to some earlier questions, also point out that there is evidence in the record about the reporter, Judge McElvain's knowledge of this part of the report that was not published or not written, according to the date on it, until 5 months after the broadcast. And in this is the summary judgment proof filed by the movement. It's got excerpts from the deposition of Mr. McElvain at Exhibit C. And at page 71 of that deposition, he admits that he was not aware. He'd never seen a final report from her.
Can I ask you the same question I asked previously? If you put the news broadcast side by side with the PIRG report, is it correct?
Yes, Your Honor. No, it's not correct. There are discrepancies.
What are they?
First, there's a discrepancy that there's nowhere in the report that it states that any of the two employees were used to perform household tasks in Mr. Emory Jacobs' home. It says that they went to visit his sick father. It doesn't say they were doing household chores. I think there's a significant difference in the appropriate attached to those statements. Secondly, it does not, the broadcast never mentions that the police investigators also obtained denial from these people. Joyce Moore denied any of this wrongdoing. Emory Jacobs Jr. denied any of this wrongdoing. Two other employees who were allegedly engaged in this, Francis Wakefield and Joyce Geerner, both told the investigator, according to the report, that this had not happened. So if they are entitled to rely on the report, why isn't that in the broadcast? If they're going to give a fair, true, and accurate, impartial account of the report, or non-existent report, but I suppose we have an inference that he was talking to someone who knew the contents of the report. There's certainly no proof that he was talking to someone who knew the contents of the report. If we have that inference, why isn't he also required to find out about the denials and broadcast those? Is he going to rely on a statute that requires a fair, true, and impartial account of the report?
So if he included in the report that all these allegations are denied by the principals, then it would have been defamatory?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that would get him off the hook. But I think if he wants to take advantage of the statute, then he's got to follow the statute. He can't have it both ways.
Is there any summary judgment evidence that controverts the truth of the broadcast?
Yes.
What is it?
Affidavit from Lila Lewis, who was one of the persons mentioned in the report as having made the allegation. The respondents filed an affidavit by her saying that the allegations were false, that none of this had occurred, and not only that, that she never made those allegations to anyone. Not only that, that she never talked to Judge McElvain before the broadcast, although he testified under oath in his deposition that she was one of his sources. Similarly with Lori Williams, there's an affidavit from her and she denied ever talking to Judge McElvain before the broadcast, and he named her as one of his sources. Actually, he said it was a lady, he couldn't remember if it was Lori Williams or if it was Lila Lewis, but one of those two ladies was his primary source. Those two ladies are the only sources that he named. Everyone else he insisted that was confidential or was anonymous. He wouldn't tell us. And we asked him on his deposition what his sources were so we could find out if they were credible.
Yeah, counsel, let me see if we could narrow the dispute here. Let's take them line by line. The report says the city's public integrity section is investigating the use of city employees for private work in the home of the city water maintenance manager. That is true, is it not?
The
the fact that city employees were...
The city's public integrity statement is investigating.
The statement that there's an investigation...
That's true.
As far as I know, it's a true statement. But it's my position that that doesn't get them off the hook.
Well, we'll take them line by line.
That's not true. That's simply... it's not...
Is it fact? I mean, is it true? Is it happening? Is there an investigation or not? I mean, that's all it says.
Yes, Your Honor. There was an investigation, but it does not show the truth of the underlying allegations. That's where we disagree. And it's my position under Texas law, they cannot publish the underlying allegations and get away with it really by saying that it's attributable to somebody else.
Well, are you contending that this statement is true or untrue? You know, we've got one line of the very first...
The defamatory statements are untrue. The fact that there's an investigation into the fact that the same lies were being told to the police that were being told to Judge McElwain is true. Well, we don't know who was telling those lies because Judge McElwain was telling.
I'm not talking about any lies. I'm talking about whether or not there's an ongoing investigation by the public integrity section of employees for private work in the home of the city's water maintenance manager. That is true.
If I could point out, you know, this court is required under summary judgment law to presume that the underlying allegations are false. Because there were affidavits from the respondents saying the underlying allegations were false. Also from a lot of Lewis saying they were false. This court must indulge all inferences in favor of the non-movement's testimony and must presume that the underlying allegations are false. So that's why I say, to bring the point home, that yes, it's true there was an investigation, but it doesn't matter just because the same lies were being told to the PRG people as were presumably being told to Mr. McElwain. And from all the evidence shows, it could be one anonymous or confidential source who's spreading all these lies to the same people. But to answer your question, it's clear there was an investigation going on at some point. Now, the time period, I'm not sure, had been established. The report wasn't written until 5 months after the broadcast. Mr. McElwain would now have us infer that he was talking to someone close to the investigation, but he wouldn't tell us that in the trial court.
Reporters rarely reveal their sources, and I don't think you're asking us for to have a right into this opinion that reporters have to reveal their sources, or are you?
I haven't raised that issue. It was raised in the trial court, but I don't think that reporters should be entitled to publish falsehood, and then their only defense be, I have an anonymous source that I can't tell you about.
All right, so you admit there's an investigation. Do you admit also that the report later on confirms the fact that some employees were putting in some overtime?
No, Your Honor. In the first place, the report is hearsay, in my opinion. It's not...
What report? The TV report or the PRG
report? The PRG report. The affidavit simply says, this is a report I prepared. If you read the report, during the affidavit, does Brenda Loudermilk ever say she had personal knowledge of any of the facts contained in that report? The report's not admissible as a public record under 803.8 of the Rules of Civil Evidence because it didn't concern the PRG agency. There's no evidence that it was an investigation that was required by law. And there's one other element in there, which is basically the same thing, that there has to be a requirement that if something's done that's required by law, something that's observed and reported, that's required by law to be observed and reported, it comes in under 803. So it was my opinion that that report is total hearsay. It does not establish anything. We presented controverting affidavits to say everything in that report is false.
If newspapers couldn't report hearsay, there'd be awful thin newspapers, wouldn't they?
That's true, Your Honor. We're not saying they can't report it. We just want them to compensate the people if they hurt when they do it negatively. They can report it like anything they want. We're not trying to censor it.
Your position is that if this were a grand jury indictment, reporting it would be privileged, but because it is something less formal, it's not a proceeding under the statute. Is that
yes, Your Honor, that's correct. If every police investigation was a proceeding under the statute, we would be in trouble because every whispered confidential statement on a street corner from a junkie to a police officer could be printed in the newspaper with absolutely absolute impunity just by simply saying it was done in the course of an executive proceeding. So we need to distinguish between the concept of truth as a defense, which is absolute, and the privilege. It's our position, if I could just follow up on my statement about this court being required to presume and indulge all inferences in favor of the non-movements, I've written down the things that it's our position this court must present. First, that the underlying allegations concerning the performance of personal services on city time, the improper collection of overtime, and the use of alcohol on the job, and the implication that a gun had been kept on the premises, although it wasn't found, Joyce Morrison, as they say, was a cigarette lighter. That wasn't in the report, the broadcast. All those things must be presumed to be false, because we submitted controversy and affidavits that said they were false. Second, even if city employees did visit or care for the father of Emory Jacobs Jr. on city time, there's no evidence that he was aware of the fact. Excuse me, this court must presume he was not aware of the fact, because he submitted a controversy and affidavit saying he was not aware. Did not ask him to visit his father on city time, would not have approved overtime for that, would not have approved city pay for that.
He was in the hospital at the time they were taking care of his father, correct?
The father was in the hospital. He was there visiting at one point when they were there, but he said that it was on a lunch hour, on a break, and that he thought they were coming there in the morning and maybe after work or on break. He was not aware they were doing it on city time. This court must accept that as true under summary judgment practice. Three, this court must presume that Judd McElvain never talked to Lotta Lewis or Lori Williams before the broadcast, who are the only named sources in his deposition or any of the summary judgment evidence. But Lotta Lewis and Lori Williams both filed affidavits on behalf of the respondents saying they never talked to him before the broadcast. So this court must presume they didn't.
Hard to. Can he obtain his information from other sources?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean, are they required to?
Well, can he not obtain his basic underlying information that's used in the report from other sources?
He may be able to, but he testified under oath he got a lot of from Lotta Lewis or Lori Williams, and I think the jury can draw an inference from that as to his state of mind as to whether he had any doubt. He said he did talk to other employees after the thing about the liquor incident. He never told us who his confidential source was for our issue. The only thing he ever really said was that he confirmed with somebody at PIRG, or at least it was inferred that he did, that the investigation had occurred. That doesn't speak to the truth of the underlying allegations. The mere fact that they've been repeated to a PIRG investigator doesn't give him any peace of mind that he can assume it's true just because someone repeated it to somebody else. This court must presume that Lyle Lewis never made allegations contained in the broadcast or in the PIRG report. She denied under oath that she ever made those allegations to anyone. The court must presume that Judge McElvain and the petitioners never saw a copy of any kind, preliminary or otherwise. And I didn't finish my site in Judge McElvain's deposition, also on page 82. He says he was never aware that there was a final PIRG report. He never saw one. He admits he never saw one.
It is your position that they must determine the accuracy of what they report before they report it?
Yes, Your Honor, they must take some steps, assuming we're not in a privileged situation here.
Yeah. Now, let's think it through. Here we are dealing with freedom of the press. You're saying the press cannot report. Somebody said, there's an investigation going on, until the press verifies that there is an investigation, in fact, going on. Is that your position?
No, even if they verify there's an investigation going on, they can't publish the underlying allegations. Even by saying there's an investigation into these allegations. If arrests have been made, and it's that kind of investigation, then they can go get the arrest report.
Does this all go out the window, your theory, if your client is public figure?
No, because I think they did not establish the absence of malice under this court's decision in Castro and Carl. Castro v. Brand, one that this court just issued in May. Even there, this court made it easier to get a summary judgment based solely on the affidavit of an interested witness. However, it did require that some evidence be presented in my affidavit stating that the defendant thought the information was true, or was not aware that it was false, or had no serious doubt about whether it was true or false. And again, we're not talking about the question of whether an investigation was occurring, we're talking about the truth of the underlying allegations. That's what they've got to have not have serious doubts about. That's a defamatory matter. And they never did that in this case.
They didn't meet this court's test in Castle v. Brand and in Carr v. Brasher.
If you look at page 7 of Carr v. Brasher, you have clear definitions of malice, reckless disregard, and you're saying they don't meet those standards?
That's correct, Your Honor. They didn't submit any affidavit saying they thought it was true. They didn't submit any affidavit saying they didn't have any serious doubts about the underlying allegation. In fact, in his deposition, I believe it's at page 103, he says it wasn't his job to determine whether there was, whether the investigation was true or false, or whether there was any fault in the investigation.
Are you saying that they acted with a high degree of awareness of probable falsity?
I'm saying they didn't conclusively prove that they did not act with such a high degree of awareness of probable falsity. They submitted no evidence that they did not act with a high degree of probable falsity.
I'm wondering where your theory that you were giving before I asked my question, how it would fit in, say, to the Watergate investigation. And if our local papers wanted to report what was being said by the Washington Post and the New York Times, what kind of knowledge do they have to have about Deep Throat in order to make that kind of report without facing, I suppose, fairly astronomical damages given the fringe benefits that Mr. Nixon's office carried?
In the first place, the distinction is, of course, that Mr. Nixon is clearly a public official. There's no question that he was a public official.
Right, that was what I was thinking when I asked my question. Does your whole theory hinge on the lack of a public official?
Well, let me go back and say it's not just that, because I also think even if this court says he's a public official under the Texas law, they've got to get a summary judgment now. They've got to submit some evidence that they did not have any serious doubts. They didn't do that.
So what I'm saying is, had Nixon chosen to sue the Dallas Morning News for repeating a Washington Post story, he could have come in and gotten some real damages. I'm talking millions. Unless the Dallas News said, well, we had no serious doubts that everything that Deep Throat was telling Woodward and Bernstein was true.
First, no, because in this court's decision, Foster v. Laredo newspapers, he's got a first proof of negligence.
Well, I'm talking about getting a summary judgment. Let me back up. Not millions of dollars. Because the Dallas News have avoided trial.
He's going to avoid a summary judgment. He's got to show that, the newspaper, Dallas newspaper, has got to show that they had no serious doubt.
Okay.
They've got to submit an affidavit that says, I got this from the Washington Post. I think they're reliable. I never had any reason to doubt them.
No, they're just a tail maker, though. I mean, they've got to show no, as what I think you were telling, they have to have no serious doubts about the truth of the report, not just about the accuracy of their source.
Exactly. But if they can show that they were confident in the accuracy of their source, I think that raises, that is some evidence that they had no serious doubts about the truth of the underlying allegation.
So the problem with McElvain was that his sources weren't as good as, say,
One of his problems is we don't know who his sources were first, and second, the only sources he named.
They don't know that they were in Watergate either. Nobody knows till this day.
Okay, well, the only sources, we have the added fact that the only sources he named denied they ever talked to him before the broadcast.
Everybody that could possibly be Deep Throat has denied it. But anyway, I've carried that all long enough. I'm just trying to see where your position is.
My position is very simple. Under the Carr v. Brasher in the Castle case, now in Texas, it's very easy to get a summary judgment. If there's no controverting evidence, if you just simply file an affidavit saying, I thought it was true, I didn't have any serious doubt it was true, I didn't have any reason to think it wasn't true, and assuming that there's not any peculiar set of facts there, that affidavit's filed, the plaintiff's got to come forward with some controverting evidence to show that there was ground for serious doubt. Let me point out also that in this case, this court is required to presume that the underlying allegations were false. I think, and indulge all inferences, I think there's a reasonable inference presuming all the allegations were false, that if Mr. McElvain had talked to the employees like he said he did, he would have been told that they were false by some of them, if not all of them. That's a presumption and a reasonable inference this court can make. And if he was told they were false, or if he'd read the preliminary report and seen Joyce Moore's denial and Nimrod Jacobs Jr. denial, the two other employees' denial, that's sufficient to raise a doubt in his mind as to whether the underlying allegations are true.
That's a period. That's no. They're assuming there's some semicolons in there. Are there any other questions?
Counsel, I just have one, and that is the affidavit of the assistant city attorney, Brenda Loudermilk, She states that she has personal knowledge of everything contained in this affidavit.
The affidavit only says this is a report that was made by me in the course of my duties. It doesn't say she has knowledge of everything in that report. The affidavit is separate from the report. So this is a true and correct copy of the report. That's all the affidavit says.
Counsel, this is not an easy case. You're not required to file a brief, but it will be very helpful to us to have a brief.
I will, whatever your word processing problems are, if you have to write it by hand.
I'll have it to you tomorrow, the next day, without failure, Your Honor, and I hope the court will be kind enough to read it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. William Ogden will present rebuttal argument for petitioner.
May it please the court, let me first turn to the point that's come up in both prior presentations. Addresses how the reporter got his information and what his sources are. It is petitioner's position that the source of the story is legally irrelevant under section 73.002. The statute itself does not speak to definition of the source or timing of the broadcast in relation to the government report or proceeding. What the statute requires for the privilege to apply is only the determination, which is one of law, that the broadcast or the account is a fair, true, and impartial account of the proceeding or report that is in the book. And this point has been made before in Texas in the case of Walker versus Globe News, 395 Southwest 2nd, at page 689, where the court held, Amarillo Court of Appeals, the fact that the newspaper reporters testified by deposition they did not get their information from the file instruments themselves is of no significance. The Sixth Circuit has opined on the same point in a well-written opinion in the brief that we urge to the court's careful attention, Medico versus Time, 643 Federal 2nd at 134. This is a Time magazine report concerning allegations of mafia connections in an FBI investigation. And the court concluded, how a reporter gathers his information concerning a judicial proceeding is immaterial, provided his study, his story, is a fair and substantially accurate portrayal of the events in question. As Mr. Wiley pointed out, to rule otherwise and to require the news media to have the report in hand prior to the time that they may comment on it to prove some implied element of reliance in this statutory privilege, which is nowhere in the reported case law, raises a serious question of prior restraint. It means that an artful agency or an artful governmental body can control the flow and dissemination of news about its proceedings simply by timing the release of its report. There is no requirement that those sources be identified, and there's no requirement that the news media rely on the written report itself. If they don't, they're at risk unless their report is fair, true, and accurate. Much has been made here about whether or not certain employees who work for Mr. Jacobs and Ms. Moore were willing to say in the cold light of day that they talked to the news media. It is obvious and understandable why they would not want to admit that. But more to the point, and the last point on this source issue, I refer the court to the slip opinion of the Court of Appeals, page 6. This was respondent's 12th point of error of the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals, in our mind, correctly confirmed that it was not properly presented or preserved. So that point is not here. It's not presented because it was not included in the written response to the motion for summary judgment. And under Rule 166A and this court's opinion in City of Houston versus Clear Creek Basin Authority, that point is not before you because it was not in the written response to summary judgment. So the source issue, we think, is a red herring. It can't be a requirement for the privilege to attach. It can't be a burden on the media to await the timing of the government's report to disseminate news of public interest, and it's not properly preserved. Questions have been raised about the discrepancy between the report and the broadcast. I'll remind the court of the point in our brief that I feel there are none in response to Justice Cook's question. even if there are, the test under Walker versus Globe News, Price versus Mullins, 697 Southwest 2nd, at page 717, the test, I'll remind the court, is one of substantial accuracy. What Crike says is, does the sting or gist imparted by the account or broadcast have the same effect on the mind of the listener that the truthful facts or the investigated facts themselves would have if those were made known? The critical test, again at page 717, 697 Southwest 2nd, is the effect on the mind of the reader or listener. If the effect on the mind of the recipient would be the same, any variance between the actions charged and the actions proved should be disregarded. To the same effect with the earlier opinion of the Amarillo Court of Appeals in Walker versus Globe News.
But if we have to look at the truth of the underlying allegations, isn't there a fact question in this case?
That's exactly right, and that's why you do not have to look to the truth of the underlying allegations.
Because this is a proceeding.
That's right. It's two things within 731002, subsection 1B and subsection 1C. It is a proceeding to, let me get the wording right here, under B, it is an official proceeding to administer the law, and under C, it is an executive proceeding, which may differ in some fact from an official proceeding, but there's no doubt that the affidavit and the report by their terms make plain that the city attorney's office, at the request of the mayor, is investigating, as the executive arm of city government, is investigating alleged legal violations. So it's both a proceeding to administer the law and a proceeding from the executive focusing on legal violations.
Would it make any difference if it was just a plain old police investigation?
I'm not certain of the answer to that. There are cases, one is a Missouri Court of Appeals case, which is cited in the brief, it's Lammy versus, I can't recall the citation. In the Lammy case, there was a publication of a DPS report charging Mr. Lammy was one who had his driver's license suspended for 30 days for driving while intoxicated. The DPS report was an error. The Court of Appeals in Missouri applying the same restatement privilege, section 611 of the restatement second of course, held that nonetheless the republication of a official report which was in error was still privileged under the meaning of section 611. My position, I think that the news media should have the right to report what's going on, have the right to rely on police reports, investigative reports, and formal actions of the city government. I don't think you have to reach your question here because I think there's evidence in the record that the Public Integrity Review Group is something more than that. This isn't, in the case cited by the respondent, this isn't a report of someone's confession to a state trooper. This is more than that. This is a conclusion reached by the city attorney's office. And the conclusions were signed by the city attorney. We have the affidavit of the assistant city attorney and the affidavit of the police officer who conducted the investigation.
Yeah, but this report, though, is 4 or 5 months after the fact, after the report, though.
That's exactly right.
Do you see any significance to the timing of it?
No, I do not. The Medico versus Time opinion and what the other case that I cited to you from Walker versus Globe News, I think, speak to.
How long a gap can there be?
Any gap as long as it's newsworthy. That's the test in section 73.002A, the last sentence. You lose the privilege if you're reporting on something so remote in time that it has, in the language of the statute, ceased to be a public concern.
But the report can come out years later.
That's where you get into a question as to whether this privilege applies. That would be, I think, a legitimate inquiry as to whether or not the journalist was entitled to the privilege. If the discrepancy between the two were so great that he were reporting on something which was no longer of public concern, but realize that the gap in time we'd be talking about there would be switched. We'd be talking about a report that occurred months or years after the investigation was over.
Is it okay if the investigation hasn't started yet? In other words, a newspaper reporter's report causes an investigation to start, and it then turns out, after all the investigation is done, it's all false. But can a reporter run to this statute?
Well, I'm not certain of the facts that you have in mind. I think that...
Well, I mean, let's suppose the PI, Public Integrity, whatever unit was, got the idea to make this investigation because they saw McElvain's TV report, rather than he got wind they were starting a preliminary investigation.
There may be an argument then that, in fact, the journalist had done this in the public service, but... If that would, again, there's no
that
way
may be for the jury to decide.
There's no way to verify that without getting into the question of what is the source for the report, which under the Medico and Walker cases is not a component of privilege and is not in the statute that defines it.
Well, you sure can't take a district attorney's office and screw up somebody's campaign really badly by just going over the reporter's door and say, why don't you just tell me that you might start an investigation with this candidate.
That report, and without those facts, Justice Gray, I think would present a good case for a report that was not fair, true, and impartial. And that would also fit the subsection A, possibly definition of malice, a personal abuse of the reporting privilege to accomplish an ulterior motive. But that's not what happened here. I just don't think those are our facts. We're asking that the court reverse the Court of Appeals and render the judgment, again, the trust that the Court of Appeals should have, to affirm the summary judgment of the AG District Court.
Any questions? Thank you.
The court will take another brief recess.